And we're back. This is Spin Doctor's Archive, the podcast. My name is Daniel, and you are listening to episode 3 of the Spin Doctor's Discography Conversations with Aaron Comas, the Spin Doctor's drummer. Over the past year, we had a few Zoom meetings to discuss the band's official music releases, starting from their early demo recordings in the late 80s up to their upcoming 7th album. And today, it's all about Turn It Upside Down, the band's 1994 follow-up to their best-selling album Pocketful of Kryptonite. Before we begin, I'd like to shamelessly promote spindoctorsarchive.com. If you are a fan of Spin Doctors, be sure to bookmark our site in your browser. We are your go-to for all things Spin Doctors. Set lists, discographies, news, song informations, link to numerous live recordings, and much more. You can also connect with us on Facebook and Instagram by searching for Spin Doctors Archive. Okay, ready? Here's interview number 3. Enjoy. Aaron, great to have you here again.
Great to see you, my friend.
Let's talk about my favorite album of all time.
Wow.
Very interesting one in the Spin Doctors catalog. It's the second studio album of Spin Doctors, Turn It Upside Down, released in May of 1994. It consists of 13 tracks: Big Fat Funky Booty, You Let Your Heart Go Too Fast, Cleopatra's Cat, Hungry Hermits, Biscuit Head, Indifference, Bags of Dirt, Mary Jane, More Than Meets the Ear, Larrabee's Gang, At This Hour, Someday All This Will Be Road, and Beasts in the Woods. Aaron, as always, what do you remember from those recording sessions? How did this album became what it is?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I remember is we, for the first time since the band started, we took a 6-month break after all the touring from Pocketful of Kryptonite. You know, because as you know, that whole process, it took a long time before the record broke. And then when it did, we had the tour, and then it broke around the world. So it was like 3 years of constant touring. So whatever it was, like maybe the end of 93 or whatever, we finally took a break and we took a nice little chunk of time. But then it was like, okay, we got to make a new record. We wanted to be on the road again for next summer. And so I remember one of the really fun things about it was Chris had bought a place out he had bought a farmhouse outside of Seattle, and he was living out there during that time. So we decided, let's go out.
Isn't this the place where you did the Mary Jane video?
It is. Exactly. I see. So we went out there to do some writing. We're like, we need to, you know, let's get together and do some writing and get some material together, figure out what we're going to do for this record. So we went out and spent a week or 10 days at Chris's house. We had a really nice time and we just wrote songs. And I think about half that record was new material and half that record was songs that leftovers from our huge catalog of original material that we had, you know, written on those first 3 or 4 years of being a band. Cause we always felt like there were a lot of really great songs that didn't make Kryptonite. And, ultimately, we wanted to record some of those for Turn It Upside Down. So Turn It Upside Down was kind of a mix of some of the old stuff and some of the new stuff. So we wrote a bunch of songs at Chris's place. And then, like I said, some of those made it. So then from there, I can't remember what happened. We went back home. We decided to do the record with the same team again. So we got, there's a little more to this story than I'm telling you. So I'll backtrack. First, I'll say we decided ultimately to use the same team to record the record, which was Peter Denneberg, Frankie LaRocca, and us, and just co-producing together. And ultimately, we went into a studio called, you would know, it's probably in the liner notes. Great studio on the west side of Manhattan, Clinton Studios. We went to Clinton Studios, and we recorded the record. But before I move on, let me backtrack a little bit. Because during that whole period of touring like fiends, you know, there was always talk and pressure to get back in the studio and make a second record. So we actually had a couple attempts in the second record. There were actually two previous attempts at that record before the one we ended up with. The first one was with this great producer, legendary guy, Jim Dickinson. Jim, incredible keyboard player, played with everybody. He played on Wild Horses, the Rolling Stones, lived in Memphis. So he came up to New York and met us, so we decided to work with him. And we went down and spent a couple of weeks at Ardent Studios in Memphis with Jim. And we recorded. And we had a nice time. It was a good session. But the problem was, is this was all in between us touring, and we were really burnt out. We weren't really focused on the record. You know, we didn't have any, holy shit, look at that.
Yeah.
Wow, where'd you get that? He's holding up a demo of that.
Chris sent me a bunch of stuff that he wanted to get rid of, and was like, please check if it's worth keeping it.
Oh my God, that's so great.
I think this is from that session. But yeah,
that's definitely from those sessions, Ardent. So we didn't have any new material. We were just going in there, recording stuff that we had. And again, we had a lot of great songs. So, but in those sessions, you've heard them. I mean, they were cool. Part of me wishes we would have maybe seen that record through with Jim and come back when we were more sort of focused. But that didn't really work out.
I remember an article from back in the day where one of you guys said that the record company thought the material was too dark in a way.
Yeah, it was a pretty dark record. It was kind of like, you know, again, we were like roadkill. You know, we were out on the road. We were like, things were blowing up. In fact, I remember we were in the studio and Frankie LaRocca showed up with the cover of the Rolling Stone before it came out. And he's showing it to us. You know, we didn't even know. Like, hey, guys, look at this. We're like, oh, fuck.
You know, oh, so my.
We're just like, you know, it's like we're just all over the place, you know. We're like, psyched, this is great, but we're like sort of thrown into the studio, and really we probably should have just been like home for a couple of weeks taking a break. But yeah, I don't think the record company really liked it much. There wasn't anything on it that really stood out. It didn't have a sort of a, like Kryptonite, it sort of just jumps out of the speakers, and it's got like, you could tell these guys are having a really good time, which we were. I think that's one of the reasons Kryptonite is such a good record. And so anyway, those sessions were darker. But they were cool, and we learned a lot. It was great working with Jim. Mm-hmm. So we moved on. Then we did another session a few months later back at the power station, and we just went in. I think it was an engineer named Steve Boyer, if I remember correctly. Nice guy, good engineer. And we just sort of went in there, and we cut a bunch of songs. And that session was really no better, really. It was just sort of like, you know, nothing special about it. Mm-hmm. And ultimately we decided, you know what, fuck this. What are we doing? Let's go back and work with Peter. You know, why mess around? You know, we got a great team. We love Peter. We're comfortable. He knows how to make us sound. Like, I don't think we were really happy sonically the way anybody was making us sound. And we're like, let's go back with Peter. We know it's going to sound great. So that's exactly what we did. And we had Frankie come and Peter, and we went in, and then we went to Chris's and did that songwriting session. After a well-needed break, so we were kind of rejuvenated. And in the meantime, like going back a bit, we didn't really need to put out a record all those times. I think we were making a new record thinking that Kryptonite was just going to die and we needed to have a record ready. But Kryptonite just kept living. It just kept getting bigger and bigger. And then it kept getting bigger around the world. So, you know, there was still like another year or two of touring. So we didn't really need to be making that record then. So,
but as you said earlier in our conversation, back in the day, bands were like supposed to bring out albums every 2 years or something.
Right. But that cycle started to change even in the 90s because, you know, things would last, you know, they were milking record cycles more. They were lasting longer. MTV, you put out another video, another single. Things just kind of kept going, and Kryptonite just kept going, you know. By the time we were at Ardent with Jim Dickinson, I think Two Princes was just coming out. So it was like, you know, once that came out, it blew up to another level. And then it started to blow up in Europe, you know? So anyway, so finally, after a much needed break and after a writing session at Chris's farm, we decided to go in the studio with Peter Denneberg again and Frankie. And that brings us to the RPM, I'm sorry, to the Clinton sessions. And those were a lot of fun. You know, I think it was, we're in a pretty good frame of mind. And it was pretty easy. We just sort of went in there and like did it. There wasn't a lot of pre-production, if I remember correctly. I think the very first song we recorded was Big Fat Funky Booty, if I remember correctly. And we used the first take. It was just felt great. We're like, okay, you know, we were like just sort of, we were in a good vibe, you know, and we had.
Let me ask about Big Fat Funky Booty. Did you leave this one and at this hour out on purpose on Homebody Groove to include it for Turn It Upside Down? Was this in consideration already?
You mean on Pocketful of Kryptonite?
No, it was on Up for Grabs. It wasn't on Pocketful of Kryptonite, but you left it out on Homebelly Groove as well.
Oh, I'm not sure. You know, it's interesting because you would have thought that like Funky Booty would have gone on Pocketful of Kryptonite because that
obviously,
was like one of our,
as you said, one of those white bread hits from the early days.
Yeah, I can't remember. You know, I can't remember if we even recorded it on those sessions. And you would think we did. We probably did. I don't know. It's a great question, but I mean, I think.
Because this is like the two songs that you left off of Up for Grabs. And I was like, was it on purpose? Because you already had in mind that these songs would make great additions to the second studio album.
It's possible that we thought that. I don't have a clear answer for it, to be honest with you.
Okay. So yeah, I'm sorry. I was interrupting you.
No. It's a great question. And I wish I had the answer. but I'm glad we left it off. Anyway, so that session was cool. And, you know, there were some great songs on that record. Yeah, Larrabee's Gain is one of my favorite Spin Doctor songs.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, Someday I'll Just Be a Road is one of my favorite songs on that record. And that was actually an afterthought. That wasn't even on, like, the list. And we, I remember one day at the end of the session, we were just like, let's just do that. Let's just do Someday I'll... Somebody said, let's just do this one. And we did one take, and it was great. So natural. It just played itself. And I really love it.
Let me share two observations with you concerning the Turned Upside Down album.
Sure.
As I told you earlier, this is one of my personal favorite of yours. And it's an album that is heavily loved by the hardcore Spin Doctors fans. But back in the day, you guys got some pretty bad reviews for it. Do you remember the reactions from the press or from the fan base back in the day?
Not really. I mean, I don't remember. I remember at first I thought we were getting like pretty good reviews right out of the gate, like at least over in Europe. But I can't remember. I never really try to pay too much attention to that stuff because it's like, you know, I mean, it'll make you crazy.
It got some rave reviews over here in Germany, actually. I remember Rolling Stone Germany and some other papers going crazy about the album, actually.
Yeah. I remember some good ones. And I'm sure we got some bad ones. I don't know. I mean, the thing I remember was... You know, we were coming off this massive record. I mean, Pocketful of Kryptonite sold like 10 million records around the world, you know? And so there was a lot of pressure, a lot of hype that we're going to have another huge record. And so that's kind of a difficult thing because we never expected Pocketful of Kryptonite to do so well. That thing just took a life on its own. So I think we tried to kind of have a realistic approach to Turn It Upside Down and, you know, realize like, look, the chances of that selling as many copies as the other one is not, we would love it, but it's not realistic. So, you know, I just remember like it came out and there was a major push. I mean, all cylinders going, you know, and, you know, I think in hindsight, we definitely picked the wrong single. I think we were all like kind of psyched because we loved Cleopatra's Cat. It was like a classic Spin Doctors song.
You intended this to be like a tribute to the fans in a way?
I think, you know, sort of naively thought like, you know, we just blew everybody's head off. We've been in everybody's face so hard with Two Princes and Little Miss, like this big fucking huge pop hits. It's like overkill almost, you know? And we thought, I think maybe like, you know, Cleopatra's Cat is like this cool song and maybe it won't be so like, I don't know, you know, but I think it was a big mistake, you know, honestly, because it bombed. It didn't do well. It wasn't a hit. It got a lot of airplay at first and it got a lot of MTV time and it had all the big, you know, MTV was so big at the time and it got a lot of play, but the record came out, you know, I think it came out higher in Europe. I think like in England, it debuted like, I don't know, number one or number two or something like that. And in Europe, the numbers were pretty big, but in the States, it came out, I think it debuted at like number 27 or something. And I remember everybody was expecting it to come out and like, even the record company, like, oh, it's going to be a number one, you know, this week, you know, and it came out and we were actually at, Glastonbury. We were headlining Glastonbury that year. One of the biggest shows we ever did.
Great show.
And we had a great time. And I remember we got the news like, you know, right that day, like before we went on stage, like, hey, you know, the record debuted. I think Richard Griffiths, the president of the label, was there and he was cool. He's like, don't worry, you know, it's going to turn around, you know, but it was kind of like, oh, fuck, here we go. And but anyway, you know, so I in hindsight, I always felt like we should have probably released You Let Your Heart Go Too Fast as the first one.
Which and did pretty well once it was released, right?
Right. So that was the second single that came out. And, you know, they were both of them were hits on rock radio. But, you know, back then you had rock radio and you had top 40 radio. Rock radio is kind of dead now. And rock radio was nice, you know, but I believe that You Let Your Heart Go Too Fast stalled at 41 on the U.S. pop chart. So it almost was one away from being a top 40 hit. But I think had it come out first, it would have done great. It just was more what sort of people expected from the band, at least in that world, you know. So look, you know, but I think it's a really cool record. I like the record. It still did very well. I mean, I don't know what the final numbers are. It sold over a couple million, you know. But it was definitely a big downturn, and there was a lot of tension building in the band. And, you know, as you know, soon after, you know, things got tense and Eric left the band. And it was an interesting period for the band, you know.
So let's talk about this before I share you my second observation. So, yeah, Eric left the band during the promotion cycle of the album. It was released in May or June. And then you were touring heavily. You've been in Europe, and then Eric left.
Yeah, well, we did Woodstock.
Yeah.
And we did...
A couple of days later...
Well, we did a bit. Yeah, that was right in the middle of our big summer tour. All right, we were headlining. We had Jim Blossoms and Cracker opening. Yeah. The big tour, but things were not great behind the scenes. And yeah, Eric left. Like we were in San Francisco. We played the Greek Theater, and Eric left after the Greek Theater gig. And then we were scheduled to go to the next morning to take a flight to Christmas to Seattle and go do the video for Mary Jane, which was going to be the next single at Chris's farm. And Eric didn't, that was when Eric, he didn't show up. That was that. And, you know, it was what it was, you know?
I always thought it was kind of impressive that the whole machine still was working. I mean, you were still touring. There was the whole European tour was booked, and Mary Jane, the video came out without a guitar player. The auditioning of a guitar player, the theme of the video. So have you been too big to fail for that particular moment?
Well, we were in the middle of a huge tour. We were getting ready to go out on tour with the Rolling Stones. You know, we had to finish our tour in the States, which was a big tour. And then we went over to Europe, and then we were opening for the Stones. And so we had a whole year of commitments on the books. And we're still trying. We're still hoping we can turn this record around. You know, we hadn't even gone over to Europe yet to do like the real push over there. So we didn't want to just, what were we going to do? You know, we had to get a new guitar player, and that we just did, you know, we got Anthony and we just proceeded on, you know.
Yeah. We'll talk about Anthony, I think in the next chapter,
in hindsight, we probably should have all tried to get it together and had Eric remain in the band. But it was just, you know, it's just so much going on, and there was so much pressure, and you're in the middle of it, and you're young, and you know, it just didn't happen. It didn't work out. So
okay, so here's my second observation about Turn It Upside Down. A lot of people are wondering why you're not playing more of those tracks nowadays in the shows. I mean, there are lots of explanations for that. But there's one thing you were mentioning that recording that songwriting session at Chris's farm with songs like You Let Your Heart Go Too Fast, Biscuit Head, Beasts in the Woods, More Than Meets the Ear. You never revisited that material after you reunited with Eric, but you're doing Big Fat Funky Booty, Cleopatra's Cat. So I got the idea that maybe those tensions were older than like August of 1994. And is there a reason for you guys not to revisit that part of the record? Or am I over interpreting things here?
Probably overthinking it a little bit. I mean, I think that, you know, what we tend to do now more than anything is play the songs. We try to mix up. I mean, you know, I send you the set list for every gig, so you see. We try to mix them
Thank
up.
You for that.
You're welcome. We have sort of certain things that seem to really work. Like we'll tend to have like maybe certain songs we'll open with for a while, certain songs we might end with. There's certain patterns, but as you see, we rotate things a lot. And now that we have new material, that's become a big part of the show. But like, as far as songs from Turn It Upside Down, I mean, yeah, like, you know, things that kind of get played fairly often, Big Fat Funky Booty, Cleopatra's Cat. You know, for a while we were doing Hungry Hominids. We haven't done that in a while. But a lot of it, I think we just tend to like do songs that, that work. Like we, you know, you sort of get a sense of when you're playing shows all the time, what songs not only sound good now, but also, you know, people like, you know, react to. And it's different than just like, I mean, I know you, you're a diehard. You want us to, you want to see like, God, I wish they would do like More Than Meets the Ear or something, you know?
Of course.
Like, we haven't played the, you know, we haven't played the song in like 25 years probably, you know? So like, and there have been off, there have been some cases where we've tried a few songs. They just didn't sound that good. Like for instance, You Let Your Heart Go Too Fast. I would love to play that one. But for whatever
reason. You did
reason,
that back in the Brooklyn Bowl in 2018 or something.
Yeah, we
like
did
that.
It. Like, oh, did we? Once. Yeah, I mean, I know. And I, for whatever reason, it just never felt that good, you know? So it's like, if it, if we could, I wish we could, I'd love to get it back together. I mean, I think it's worth trying to pull, trying to get together because it's a great song. It was a popular song. I mean, you know, really. And it's a song that I really wish we played more. And maybe we can attempt it again. But I just noticed that when, I mean, I write the set lists, you know, and
it's one of the most asked questions on spindoctorsarchive.com, actually. A lot of people are asking why they are not playing You Let Your Heart Go Too Fast or what about
tell them Aaron
Indifference said, and so on.
I'll take full responsibility. It doesn't sound good. if we can play it well, I'll do it, you know? So maybe we just got to practice it more. But yeah, Indifference, that's a great song. We've done that a few times over the years.
Yeah.
You know? And we should put that one back in. I mean, Larrabee's Gang is one of my favorites. We've done that a few times over the years, but not a lot. I mean, I think you know, there is something to be said about what you said about like, you know, certain memories that come with certain time periods, good or bad. And I try to be a bit of a, as the guy that's writing the set list, you know, you don't want to rock the boat too much. You don't want to call, you don't want, the last thing you want to do is send out a set list and have somebody say like, I don't want to do that song.
Or doesn't
like,
feel good. Or,
that brings back a bad memory. And I don't want to be in the middle of that either. So
I see that,
you know, you try not to push certain things, but you know, listen, I mean, luckily we have a lot of songs and,
tons to choose from. Yeah.
And we try our best to spread them out. And at the same time to be really conscious about like, you know, putting on a good show for the people we're in front of, you know, and,
absolutely.
You know, it's sort of a fine line, right?
So yeah, to wrap things up for Turn It Upside Down, there is one comment from Eric that I was thinking about when preparing our conversation. He once said that he thinks the album did not end up being as strong as it could have been. So this is what he remembers from it, but he's proud of it. Something like that, he said in an interview a couple of years ago. Yeah. Would you agree?
I mean, you know, I feel like I like the album a lot. I really do. I mean, I haven't heard it in a while, but every now and then, well, like Bags of Dirt, that's a great song.
We've
done that here and there, but not a lot. I think that Turn It Upside Down is a very good album, and I think it holds up. I agree with him. It could have been stronger. I don't think it's as strong as, say, Pocket Full of Kryptonite, which I just think is just sort of like this perfect record. You know, it's like, it's not too long. It's 11 songs. To me, every song is great. It just plays perfectly from start to finish. It feels good. There's also, I think, you know, when you hear a band member like me or Eric or any of us comment on a record, you're also thinking about what was going on, like you said, in that period.
Of course,
Was there some tension going on? Was there tension with a certain song maybe? Or, you know, when, there's all kinds of little things. So like with Pocket Full of Kryptonite, everything was just perfect. Nobody had any problems with anything. And I think with Turn It Upside Down, it wasn't totally perfect, but it was pretty good. It was pretty good. But I remember there were a few sort of tensions going on. I remember a little bit of disagreement about certain songs or sequencing. So it's hard when you're in a band because everybody has to agree. And, you know, that can be difficult coming up with, you know, the sequencing or the songs you're going to pick or mixes. And you know, we're a pretty opinionated band. Everybody's pretty headstrong in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And we've gotten a lot better working together, I think, now than ever. But I think Turn It Upside Down was kind of a tense period for sure when I think about it. And I think that like anything that sort of, you know, although I do think the record really holds up and I'm really glad to hear that it's your favorite.
Absolutely.
And And a lot of people told me that. So
maybe those tensions are part of the answer to that. Yeah. I love Fucker for a Good One. Don't get me wrong, but I love the imperfections, kind of an odd sequencing at parts. But still, as a whole, this is the album to go back to if I want the classic Spin Doctor sound. And I think a lot of fans would agree.
Yeah, I think you're right. And again, a lot of our favorite records from all kinds of artists, when you get the backstories about what was going on, a lot of times it's not so much fun. I mean, I've heard all kinds of stories and met some of my heroes. And there's a couple of examples where I've been talking to people about like some of my favorite records, and they were telling me what a nightmare it was to make. And, you know, you're like, really? Are you kidding me? It's like, I'm one of my favorite records, you know? So it's like, and sometimes that ultimately that can add to the what makes a record great. So, you know, in some ways we're the worst people to ask, you know, but I feel good about that record. I think it's great. Some of my favorite Spin Doctor songs are on it. It's got a great sound to it.
So let's end this chapter with the same question as always. What is your favorite cut? One or two?
I'd have to go Larrabee's Gain on that one.
Oh yeah.
I love that song. I think it really, and that song, oddly enough, you know, it really, to me, brings me back to the time before the band was even out on the road. Cause it's all about like the scene in New York City and the Nightingale Bar.
Yeah.
And it's really about that, you know, those early years of the Spin Doctors. And I think you're right when you say like, Turn It Upside Down really does represent in a lot of ways that sort of this early period, in some ways more than Kryptonite. It's weird, you know, it's like, because there's a lot of those songs that sort of didn't make the first record that made the second record. I think I would go number one, Larrabee's Gain. And then let's see, wow, what else is on there? I mean, I think Bags of Dirt is pretty damn cool too, you know. Another really another sort of like classic Spin Doctors, kind of like Shinbone, but different. Yeah. You know, it's got really like from a musical perspective, it really represents the elements of the four of us. All of our personalities really shine on that. Again, classic lyrics by Chris, you know, Mark and me and Eric, really kind of like Shinbone. It's in that vein where all the four elements really just stand out. And Larrabee's Gain is more of just like, just an incredible song, you know. It's just so, that's an incredible.
So Larrabee's song. And Bags of Dirt.
Yeah, I'll go with those two.
It just popped into my mind that I need to ask you something else. I'm so sorry. But whatever happened to that break in Hungry Hermits that was on Piece of Glass, but didn't make it to Turn It Upside Down, this triplet thing? I loved it on Piece of Glass, actually.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I think we just finally got rid of it, you know. I remember that was just something that Eric came up with and wanted to add, and I think ultimately it always kind of reminded me of like a Blues Traveler thing or something. I think he'd actually sort of like taken like a Blues Traveler type idea and throwing it in, because you know, we were playing together so much and had each other's shows, and I think that was sort of like, that was what it was. I think ultimately it was a great part, and it was really cool.
And if you want to listen to the Piece of Glass version, is out everywhere, so you can listen to that as well.
I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like we might have brought that back a little, like about 5 years ago, and done that at a few shows. I almost feel like when we put out the 25th or the 20th Kryptonite anniversary, And we put Piece of Glass and Can't Say No. I think we might have heard that and been like, let's do that.
You probably did it.
I think we might have actually done that arrangement at a couple shows.
But I wasn't fortunate enough to experience that myself.
I don't know if anybody taped it, but anyway, I may be wrong, but I kind of vaguely remember like bringing that back.
When I saw you in Prague in 2005, you ended the show by teasing Hungry Hermits. You only did dun 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 dun, and the show was like, no!
Yeah, we do that sometimes.
Yeah. Okay, Aaron, thank you very much for this conversation.
Oh, my pleasure.
Okay, Aaron was completely correct about the instrumental part in Hametz that we discussed. The band brought it back a couple of years ago, along with a tease of the Popeye theme song. For instance, on October 13th of 2011 at the Bowery Ballroom in New York City, they performed it as an anchor during the Pocketful of Kryptonite anniversary tour. And here's a little snippet from an audience recording of that night. To listen to the full show, check the show notes for a link. By the way, a fully mixed and mastered soundboard recording of this show was officially released back in the day as a limited edition double CD set by a company named Rockhouse Live. For more information on this release, check the Spin Doctors album discography on, of course, spindoctorsarchive.com. That's all for now. Please remember to subscribe to this podcast. And if you enjoy this nerdy little show, please give it a 5-star rating on Apple or Spotify. The next episode will be about the 1996 album You've Got to Believe in Something. And again, I'm really looking forward to this one. My name is Daniel Heinze. Thanks for listening. Until next time, Mao Bi Zhao.